Hey, are we live yet? Are we live yet? Testing. 1, 2, 3. Welcome to Gnostic Media Research and Publishing's online podcast with your host, Jan Irvin. Here we investigate the religious, the mysterious, the entheogenic, the shamanic, and the Gnostic with the small g. Haven't heard it someplace else, you'll likely hear it here. So sit back and relax. Take a trip through time and a journey through your mind as we investigate the ancient mysteries. Hello everyone and welcome to Gnostic Media's podcast number 3. This is your host, Jan Irvin. Before we get started with the interview with Dr. Martin Ball, I have a few announcements I'd like to make. First, I'd like to say that my new book, The Holy Mushroom, Evidence of Mushrooms in Judeo-Christianity, is finally available for pre-order. This book breaks down the arguments against John Allegra's research in the sacred mushroom and the cross and provides new iconographic and textual evidence of the use of psychoactive mushrooms in Judeo-Christianity. It has a lot of previously unpublished medieval Christian images that are in full color. The first 100 copies are numbered and autographed. To order your copy, please go to www.gnosticmedia.com, or you can also check out www.theholymushroom.com. I'd also like to say, in light of this week's elections, whether you vote your conscience or for the lesser of two evils, please make sure you get out and vote. In California, we have Proposition 5 on the ballot, which will force the state to provide treatment and rehabilitation to nonviolent drug offenders instead of prison. So please vote yes on Prop 5. This is probably the best chance we have out right now for curbing this hideous war on drugs that's literally destroyed the backbone of American society and made human appetite as well as religion illegal. The war on drugs has not worked in its nearly 80 years of existence, and it's not going to work now. And I think it's time for a change. Speaking of the war on drugs, here's a song that was first introduced to me by a dear friend, Jeannie Brittingham Erstad, She Who Remembers, who is no longer with us. The song is by Andras Jones. Here's Drug War, which I think is quite fitting for the topic of this episode. Stay tuned.
Wiretaps on your phone, what have you done? In the privacy of your own home, what have you done? Our records reveal you've been having too much fun, and that ain't right in the New World Reich or in a drug war, because that's what we've been calling it, a drug war, because everyone's a commie in a drug war, and we've been running low on commies since the Cold War, so that's what we're calling it. Well, your high school chum went bump in the night. What has he done? For 20 years in the represent light. What has he done? 20 Z's in Dallas and he was not white. Is that all that counts? 1 year, 1 ounce in a drug war. Because that's what we've been calling in a drug war. Because everyone's a commie in a drug war. We've been running low on commies since the Cold War. Yeah, but everyone's a commie in a drug war. And everyone's a dealer in a drug war. So that's what we're calling it now. How, do 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 Drug war by digging up Joe McCarthy of the Cold War to meet the prison party in this drug war. But all the good doctors' hands are tied by the drug war, as all the bad barristers decide it's a drug war, and which pet shall be their button in a drug war. But you know that hemp could replace cotton if it were, and for all the jail cells they're filling in the drug war. Prisons make a killing, and that's the real reason for the drug war. 'Cause everyone's a commie, you can enlist and bet your army, so you can incarcerate your mommy.
This is Gnostic Media Podcast number 3. Today I'm here with Martin Ball. Martin earned his PhD in religious studies with an emphasis on Native American religion and shamanism from UCSB in 2000. He is the author of 3 books on entheogenic spirituality, Mushroom Wisdom, Sage Spirit, as well as the forthcoming The Entheogenic Evolution. Additionally, he has authored an original fantasy series, Tales of Arduin. Am I saying that right, Martin?
Yeah, Arduin.
Okay. And is also the host of the weekly podcast, Entheogenic Evolution. His books, music, and original artwork can be found on his website, www.martinball.net. Martin, welcome aboard.
Thanks, Jan. It's great to be here. It's a pleasure to kind of do this exchange. I had you on my podcast the other week, and now I'm here, so it's just fantastic to make this connection with you and be here.
Yes, and it's good to have you on, and thank you for having me on your show as well.
Yeah.
Well, I wanted to start off here a little bit by just sort of going into how you got into this field of research. You're obviously a doctor, a PhD, and what, you know, how did you get into this background? There's not a whole lot of doctors that I know out there, maybe a couple of dozen, who focus on studying ethnopharmacology. So how did you get involved?
Yeah, well, I actually entered into graduate school at UCSB intending to study Buddhist philosophy. That was kind of my main area that I was looking to go to. I was a philosophy undergraduate major and really got disillusioned by being in a philosophy department where pretty much you're just studying dead white males from Europe and America. And, you know, I talked to my philosophy professors about, you know, well, what about, you know, Asian philosophy, Buddhist philosophy, Hindu philosophy? And I actually had my professors say, well, you know, only European cultures have philosophy. Everybody else has religion. So I said, well, okay, then I'll go to religious studies. So I ended up kind of shifting my focus then into religious studies. And like I said, my intention was to study Buddhist philosophy. But when I got into graduate school, I hooked up pretty early with a professor who did Native American studies. And going into graduate school, I had actually just read all of the Carlos Castaneda books. So I was kind of into that subject, also knowing that there's some very serious questions about plagiarism and accuracy and whether, you know, any of that is even true at all. But I was very interested in that. Yeah, so I was very interested in that subject matter. And so in hooking up with this professor who did Native American studies, I just started working more in that area and eventually started going out to the Mescalero Apache Reservation in New Mexico and working with the medicine people there. And so a big part of my studies in looking at Native American traditions and shamanism, and I would say this is both Native North American, Central American, and South American, looking at all these different cultures, I mean, you just have to deal with the question of entheogens if you're going to be looking at these cultures, because they are so prevalent. I mean, much more so in Mesoamerica and South America than necessarily North America. But certainly, many examples abound. So I really had to get into studying all of this. And in a sense, it was kind of like I had two different educational systems going at the same time. I had my academic work that I was doing, and then kind of on the side, I mean, I was reading a lot of the different, works in psychedelic literature and in entheogenic literature. And then also, I would say, undergoing my own personal education process that really wasn't involved with what I was doing in the classroom at that time. So that's really the work that I was doing in religious studies. So my degree, we would say, has an emphasis on Native American traditions. But within that, I was really very interested in the question of entheogens, and not just from an academic standpoint, but also from a personal standpoint. I mean, I've never belonged to any particular religion. I did not grow up in a religious family, but I do consider myself to be a very spiritual person, and I have personally pursued my spiritual quest through the use of entheogens. So it's been extremely important to me personally, not just academically.
Well, it sounds like, as far as your experience with entheogens and things, we have a similar in that regard. I started off somewhat interested in Eastern philosophy, but never went towards studying it, and then ended up somehow in studying entheogens instead. Tell me a little bit about your is was your first book Mushroom Wisdom?
Actually, that was my fifth book.
Oh, your fifth book, really? So you have several books.
Well, what happened was, when I finished my graduate program, I really wasn't able to get a job in my field for various reasons. So I ended up kind of having a lot of time on my hand. And at that point, that was when the Lord of the Rings movies were coming out. And having just finished graduate school, not really having a job, I thought, well, hey, I can read whatever I want. I don't have to read academic tomes, which I had, been doing for years. So I thought, what on earth should I read? I know, I'll read The Lord of the Rings. So I read, well, actually, first I read the Dune series by Frank Herbert, and then I read Lord of the Rings. And then when I finished Lord of the Rings, I just felt, I want to write my own fantasy epic. So I did. It was like 10 o'clock at night. I turned on my computer and I started writing. And that ended up being four books, which I call Tales of Arduin. So it's a whole series of books. And I kind of put pretty much everything that I was interested in, from religious studies, culture, science, philosophy, history, I sort of wove it into this grand narrative. Now, after I wrote those four books, it kind of occurred to me that really, a lot of the lessons I had personally learned from my work with psilocybin mushrooms was included in these books, in the way that the characters went through their own realizations, or coming to understand themselves, or coming to understand their own spiritual nature, that I included all these ideas. So what I did for Mushroom Wisdom is I basically extracted those ideas from the Tales of Arduin series and compiled it into a book that was specifically about how I use mushrooms as a personal spiritual practice. So I kind of made Mushroom Wisdom as something of a beginner's guide to using psilocybin mushrooms. And from people who have read the book, I've been told that people feel that it's kind of a guide for pretty much any entheogen that you might use. So I'm really happy that people feel that way about it, but it was specifically written for psilocybin mushrooms. And so that's really where that book came from, is just after I wrote those novels, I was like, well, hey, there's another book in here of a whole different set of ideas. And so that's kind of how I got started writing in the area specifically of entheogens. Now, in my novels, there's actually quite a few different examples of entheogens and visionary plants and medicines that are used in the novels, but they're not intended to be like psychedelic literature per se. So Mushroom Wizard was my first venture into publishing in that area.
I must say that I've actually recommended your book, Mushroom Wisdom, to, oh, probably about 10 people since I read it a few months or a couple of months ago. And I especially find helpful your section on bad trips, because I had set out probably in about 2001 or 2002 to start writing on something on that with a similar goal in mind, but what I wrote was just going to be a short essay of 10, 15 pages, but you've actually expanded expanded the whole theme out into a book and focused very well on the difference between good and bad trips and things like that. And in fact, would you mind explaining a little bit about that from your material and your own experience?
Well, I would kind of start it out by saying that I take my encounters with entheogens very, very seriously. I mean, some people might even criticize me for perhaps being too serious in a sense. And that kind of what I was trying to get at in the book is that I'm really not even trying to talk about how to have a good trip or how to avoid a bad trip, because for me, working with entheogens is not about either having a good time or having a bad time. It is about engaging in purposeful and intentful work. And it's serious work, and it's very, very challenging. And certainly it can be very, very challenging. So I wanted to kind of get beyond this idea of, well, look, here's how you have a good trip. Here's how you feel good about yourself, and here's how you had a good time, and here's how you avoid having a bad or a negative experience. I really wanted to put it into a new level and say, well, look, you have good trips and you have bad trips, but then you also have, well, what is the spiritual trip? What is the difference between these different modalities of approaching the experience? Now, for example, like a good trip might be, you're out with your friends, you're in nature, you're feeling connected, you're feeling like you're having good experiences, it's rewarding, you're interacting well with the world around you, maybe you're connecting to spirit, you're connecting to other people, and it can be a very, rewarding and enjoyable experience. And especially, psilocybin mushrooms can be aesthetically amazing. I mean, they're just fantastic in terms of what you can see and what you can experience. Then the bad trip would be, you're with the wrong people, you're in the wrong environment, you get fearful, you get clingy, you're trying to avoid things that are coming up in your journey or something like that. And then I'm trying to say, well, look, there's even a third way, which really is this spiritual approach, which is saying, look, I'm not looking to have a fun time, and I'm not looking to avoid a bad time. What I'm doing is I'm going into an entheogenic experience so that I can take an honest assessment of myself, who I am, what's in my heart, what kind of energies I'm putting out into the world, what kind of choices I'm making, and looking at them. From in the book, I call it the perspective of the witness, where you can enter into kind of a dispassionate perspective where you can observe all these aspects of yourself. But the key to that is observing it without judgment, right? Without having any attachment to it. Now, in a good trip, we tend to be attached to our feelings of our friends or our experiences. And in a bad trip, we are fearful and we're judging things and we're being critical and we're trying to push things away. But really, the spiritual trip is one where you accept that, look, I'm going to surrender to this process. I'm going to open myself up to whatever it is that comes through with this. I'm going to remain attentive and intentful. And this is very important. I mean, especially, with mushrooms or any kind of psychedelic, it's very easy to let your mind wander and go off in any particular direction. And that can be rewarding, that can be fun, that can be insightful. But if you're really doing work with these things, you have to stay focused, you stay on task, and you keep bringing yourself back to that with compassion, without judgment, and with a willingness to say, look, I'm going to look honestly at who I am and what my life is and what I'm trying to do. And when you do that, I find that the mushrooms or any entheogen respond very well, and they will give you information. They will present things to you about yourself and about your life and about who you are. And sometimes that can be very challenging. People have to face their shadows, they have to face their dark sides, they have to face the things that they don't want to face. So in that sense, people might think, well, that sounds like a bad trip. But it's about going into it with a certain level of intent and awareness so that you're able to absorb that and learn from it. And it can be an experience of kind of tough love, in a sense, where the mushrooms say, well, look, you think that you want this out of your life, but look at all these things you're doing that are, undermining yourself. And so you have to be brave enough to really say, okay, I'm willing to learn who I am. And that can be a big struggle for people. And that's something that a lot of people are afraid of. And I think that, once you hit certain levels of entheogen use, in terms of like the strength of the experience, you kind of don't have a choice any longer, right? That if you're going to go into a high level mushroom experience, it's not about having fun. I mean, I don't know how anyone could say it's about having fun. It's not fun. It's work. It's grueling. It's challenging, but it's so profoundly rewarding. It's transformative. It's healing. So I speak very highly of it, but I think it's people have to understand it's work. It's not just about, I'm going to take some mushrooms and go to the concert and have a good time. I mean, that's one use for them. But if you really want to use them as spiritual tools, it's like I personally will go and I will lock myself in a room. I will close the door. I will light a candle. And I say, I am not leaving this room until this experience is done, with the possible exception of having to go use the restroom. But other than that, I will stay focused and go through that experience and get out of it what I am seeking to find within it. And that's a lot of work.
You would be interested in Kelly Ivor's studies on psilocybin as far as that, but we'll cover that more later. Actually, I wanted to read a little a couple of paragraphs from your book on the what you say in regard to the good trip and bad trip, if you wouldn't mind.
Sure, please go ahead.
Okay, this is from Martin Ball's Mushroom Wisdom. I believe this is page 61 or 61 to 62. On the other side is the bad trip. Bad trips where seekers are fearful and fight against the flow of the mushrooms. The environment is uncomfortable. The people are wrong. Seekers feel judged and judge themselves. So they try to stop the experience, but they can't. In fact, the more they fight, the worse it becomes, as they are beset by demons and hellish night and a and hellish nightmare images that they wish desperately to escape. Ultimately, both experiences are two sides of the same coin. The good trip reaffirms the seeker's sense of self. The seeker is with people who don't challenge one and is in an environment that is comfortable and relaxing. All the seeker is doing is reaffirming positive illusions. Similarly, on the bad trip, the seeker is being confronted by negative illusions and judgments, but gives them power by fighting against them. The primary instinct is to escape, to return to safe illusions. But if the trip is bad enough, seekers don't know how to get back to the realm of safety, and they suffer. I think that is about that just about drives a nail right through the head of what I've been trying to express to people for many years about this psychedelic and mushroom experience. And it's always very interesting to me when people come up to me and say, I had a bad trip with mushrooms, I'm never doing that again. And
Yeah.
as your book says, these experiences, they're not really, they don't just create thoughts. The mushrooms and entheogens don't just create thoughts and plant them in your mind. They bring forth your suppressed subconsciousness, and it's like a mirror looking into the recesses of the self. And if you can't face yourself, then that's always been one of the most interesting things, and that's always, in fact, how I, in a lot of ways, how I've gauged certain friendships. With people who are just adamant about not looking at themselves, and if they're afraid to look at themselves, then that's usually a big red flag to me, in fact.
Yeah, I think it's a very serious issue. I mean, culturally, I think our society doesn't like to reflect. I think that we have a very hard time looking in the mirror, and especially when we look at kind of the grand scope of our society and culture, where we put out all these ideals and we say, well, look, we're all about freedom and democracy and all of this stuff. And then when you look at what we're really doing, it's pretty clear that that is not the values that are actually driving our society. So, I mean, it goes from the large scale structure of our society down to individual people, where we have this terrible reticence to actually look at ourselves and take an honest assessment of who we are, where we're at, what's motivating us, what kinds of choices that we're making. And, I certainly have heard from people as well saying, oh, I had this mushroom journey or some other kind of entheogenic experience, and man, that was so terrible. I am never doing that again, just like you say. And kind of my reaction to that is, well, so then you want to wait until you die? Because, I mean, I know in our scientific world and all of this that we have a lot of questions about life after death and these kinds of things. I'm kind of convinced that, it's not necessarily ideas of heaven and hell, but I do think that there is a continuation of consciousness in some form. And I do think that, in the process of dying, where our egos are dissolving and our sense of self and our entire sense of world is dissolving, we are confronted with the enormity that is reality. And in that process, I believe that we will all have to face our fears in that. So when somebody says, "Yeah, I had a bad mushroom trip and I'm never doing that again because I don't want to deal with that stuff," I mean, that's just the first thought that comes to mind is, "Okay, well then you're going to deal with that at your moment of death. Would you rather, practice that now and go through it and actually be able to come to grips with it so that maybe whatever comes next is going to be better for you? Or do you just want to live in the shadows, to continue to live with these, basically these demons haunting you?" I think it's much healthier to confront them, face them, transform them, be empowered by the experience. Don't run away in fear.
And if you can't face your demons, the whole issue is if your demons therefore are yourself, and then that poses an interesting problem about one's own personality makeup and things like that that I find very interesting, to say the least. Tell me, in your book, you talk, somewhat about ritual, and I think you mentioned that you don't like to borrow the rituals of other cultures. You like to develop your own ritual for your own experience. Could you talk about that?
Yeah. Well, part of that, I would say, kind of comes from having worked in Native American studies for quite some time. Things are changing a little bit now, but particularly when I was a graduate student, there was a great deal of concern in Native American communities about non-natives taking Native ceremonies. And for example, even a group of Lakota holy people got together and they wrote a declaration of spiritual war saying that we are sick and tired of non-natives taking our sun dance and our vision quests and taking our ceremonies and using them without our permission or instruction. So they were very vocal about that. And so that's kind of that consideration that I had in writing that into the book is that, because, in dealing with things like mushrooms or other entheogens, that we can see that, of course, Native American communities and cultures have used these medicines. So the temptation might be to, well, let's just do it how they do it. And I think that that's completely legitimate, especially if someone goes and studies with a traditional medicine person or something like that. Often in that kind of relationship, a person will be given or granted rights to use certain kinds of symbols or ceremonies or rituals. For example, in my work at the Mescalero Apache Reservation, I was initiated by a couple different medicine people, and they specifically gave me ritual forms or things that I could use or medicines that I could use. And they said, "We are giving you permission to use this because we're initiating you into our medicine." Now, if I had just started doing some of those things on my own without getting that permission for them, they would have been kind of insulted by it. And offended by it. So I guess in writing that, what I'm urging people to do is to think about, well, what's authentic for them, rather than just taking some form from some other culture and saying, well, Native Americans pray to the Great Spirit, so I'm going to pray to the Great Spirit. Well, what does that mean for you, right? Is that something authentic for you? And really, what I'm trying to get at there is that in working with these kinds of medicines, we want to come from a place of authenticity, right? I'm really big on a person being honest with him or herself in going into these kinds of experiences. And if we're taking things from other people that we don't really understand or maybe don't really have permission to use, then the question of authenticity is raised. Are you doing something from a genuine sense of spiritual integrity, or are you using this ritual or this aspect or this symbol because maybe you think it's cool? Because, well, Native Americans, it's cool, so I want to use that, right? That it raises questions of authenticity within that. And I think that anyone looking to use entheogens spiritually really needs to take an honest look at their questions of intention and look very honestly at their authenticity. Are they doing this because it's genuine for them, or is it for other attachments or illusions or motivations that we might have? So that's kind of what I was trying to get at and putting that in there, that I want people to pay attention to that.
I actually agree with you on that on many different levels. And in fact, with my own use, I have intentionally stayed away from ritual because I never felt that, as you said, honest in myself and any of the rituals that were available, whether they were Western or Native American or et cetera. And so from that respect, I have always just focused my intention inward and in making the act of taking the entheogens my own ritual. And so making that the ritual itself because I didn't feel right in adopting another. In fact, there's a book that goes on into this very topic that you may find interesting or you may have read. It's by Alice Beck Kehoe, Shamans and Religion: An Anthropological Exploration in Critical Thinking. And what she does is she. In fact, she attacks the use of the word shaman itself, and she says that even the word shaman is really dedicated to the Siberian people, and Western culture's use of that word has had a major negative impact on the true shamanic Siberian cultures. And she argues that the which I don't necessarily agree with, but she argues that the Siberian tribes may not necessarily even use the Amanita muscaria, who call themselves shamans. So, the how we have taken that word and applied it to the heavy entheogen using cultures such as in South America, she has a lot of contention with. Now, my problem with her work is that, well, she provides an excellent argument, and it's good to be aware of these things, but at the same time, she doesn't really provide us a good alternative that we should use because, shamanism in its many forms, the word shaman or shamanism does cover and explain something that we're trying to get at. Now, we can break that down into dark shamanism and entheogenic shamanism and healing shamanism and herbal shamanism and then the varying cultures from that perspective as well. But, and all of that comes full circle back to the misuse of, in my opinion, of ritual and things like that too. So, anyway, thanks for putting that together. I think that's very useful, and I've tried to explain that to people before. And your book sort of wraps up a lot of things and puts them in easily digestible terms for neophytes. So I really appreciate that.
Yeah, well, thank you. That's really what I was trying to do with that book. I did get a review on Arrowood.com or Arrowood.org where the reviewer said, "Well, this is such a beginner's book. Why aren't there more like trippy revelations and things like that in the book?" And I responded on Arrowood by saying, "Well, that's not the book I was trying to write. I was trying to write a book for people who don't really understand these things but are still going to be using entheogens or mushrooms. And I'm trying to give some advice to people who don't know how to approach it from a spiritual perspective." So no, it's not supposed to be some grand philosophical, metaphysical treatise. It's practical advice in plain language to help people get the most out of their experience. So that was my intention, and so thank you for receiving it that way.
Yeah, I think that was exactly what I wrote on my review of your book up on Amazon.
Yeah.
Next, I wanted to talk a little bit about your book, Sage. Wait, what is it called again?
A sage spirit, yeah.
Sage Spirit. Could you talk? And that's that book is regarding Salvia divinorum. Is that correct?
Yeah. Yeah, I wrote Sage
Oh,
Spirit
wait.
not too long.
Let me interrupt
Yeah.
you real quick before we go on to the next subject. I wanted to ask if you'd mind
Yeah.
if I ask you or if you would mind answering for that matter, how many times you've taken psilocybe mushrooms in your life or in preparation for writing Mushroom Wisdom? Is that something you dare discuss?
Wow. No, I'm happy to discuss it. For whatever reason, rightly or wrongly, wisely or not wisely, I'm pretty open about my use of entheogens. Yeah, how many times I've taken psilocybin mushrooms over the course of my life? I don't know, honestly. I'm not entirely certain, but in the lead up to Mushroom Wisdom, I mean, I first experienced psilocybin mushrooms after my first year of college, and I tried them a few different times, and I kind of had some bad experiences with them, and then kind of felt like I was having flashbacks and things like that. So I avoided them for a little while until I got back into graduate school. And really, Mushroom Wisdom itself, the book, all the ideas that I'm working with in that book really were generated by one mushroom experience in particular, kind of after I had gone through this period of having a couple, kind of negative trips. I mean, not terrible or anything, but just like I didn't really feel good about myself in those experiences. Then I started really studying shamanism and comparative mysticism and looking at use of entheogens in traditional cultures. And then I went back to using psilocybin mushrooms, and I had this experience that, it was a very long mushroom journey. I mean, the whole thing seemed to take like 9 hours. I'm not quite sure how that happened because usually mushrooms don't go that long. But it at the time, it felt like just a profound Gnostic shamanic initiation. It's almost like the mushroom said, "Okay, well, you want to know how we work? This is how it works." And like all this information came through in this one experience. Now, I wrote Mushroom Wisdom about 10 years after that experience happened. So in the time period between then, I would use mushrooms occasionally. Being a graduate student, I didn't have a lot of opportunity for that because honestly, most of the time I was reading from 8 in the morning to 10 o'clock at night, pretty much every day. So not a lot of time in there for exploration. So how many times I've used them overall, I'm not really certain. I couldn't even venture a guess. But it's not as much as one might think, actually. And I do tend to work, especially now at this point in my life, I'm working with a lot of different medicines. I've been working a lot with ayahuasca, a lot of, with 5-MeO, DMT. So how many times? I don't know. I don't know. Good question, though.
Okay. Well, as somebody who has experienced excuse me, psilocybin mushrooms in the multi-hundreds of times, I have to say that your description and introduction to them for the beginning user, and as well, I find it useful for a good reminder for, you don't always remember things that you learn and that you need to pull back and that you should remember when you need to remember them. So your book works as a good reminder even for the expert or for somebody who's got a lot of experience like myself. Anyway, we can move on to your book Sage Spirit now. That little segue.
Yeah, I wrote Sage Spirit about a year or so after Mushroom Wisdom was published, and really, the main inspiration for that was I was doing an interview with Timothy White from Shaman's Drum about Mushroom Wisdom, and we had a really long conversation. It was actually really fantastic that at the time I was living down in Southern California and he was up here in Oregon in Williams, and we decided to meet in Berkeley in Central California. So he drove down, I drove up. And we had like a 6 hour conversation that formed the basis for my interview for his magazine. And in the process, we ended up talking a lot about Salvia divinorum because that's something that I've also worked with quite extensively. And he just kind of made the comment, said, somebody's really got to write a book for about Salvia. That you have so much great advice here in Mushroom Wisdom, but all the young people these days, they're all getting into Salvia and nobody knows anything about it. And we really need a book like that. So I said, well, okay, well. Let's see what I can put together. So, really, Sage Spirit, it's kind of different from Mushroom Wisdom. I felt that a lot of the ideas in Mushroom Wisdom applied equally well to Salvia divinorum, but I didn't want to just write the same book again and, just insert the word salvia where it said mushroom. So, I tried to focus a little bit differently in that book, and I found that actually I had pages and pages of journals of my sage experiences. And then I also, in my books, Tales of Arduin, that I had written several sections of the book that really are based on Salvia. I actually even invented a character in the stories that's kind of a combination between super strings physics and Salvia divinorum. And so I kind of worked with these ideas a lot. So I kind of used a lot of that material in writing Sage Spirit and just tried to present an overview of what Salvia divinorum is, where it comes from, what are the different methods of consuming it, how long it lasts, using these different varieties. Again, trying to focus more on practical advice and then also looking at, how do you use Salvia divinorum with other people? So I have another section in there about salvia and ritual. Really, my main thing there is when I'm working, like doing a salvia circle, my main concern is really to give every person their own individual chance to go into the experience because it's so personal and intimate and introspective. And, I've found in working with people with salvia that, other people making noise in the room or even moving can really disrupt someone's experience. So just trying to put in, again, just a certain level of practical advice for, what does it mean to work with this? Especially when you go into YouTube and you see people doing like idiotic things with salvia. It's like, God, what are you doing? Why in the world are you using this? Like, I remember one video that I saw where somebody took a bong hit of salvia and then like his friends challenged him, make a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. And of course he couldn't do it. And just my reaction is, ah, I mean, I try not to get judgmental, but I get kind of angry. Like, why are you people putting this stuff on the web? Because you know that some politician is going to take that and say, look, see, this is destroying our children. It's just, it doesn't show a lot of forethought and sense. And so I'm kind of trying to counter that in, the books that I'm writing. Say, look, come on, people, let's get serious. Let's take these things seriously because they have so much value as spiritual tools, as healing tools, as therapeutic tools. I mean, it's like if you take an astronomer and you say, okay, well, you can look with your naked eye at the stars, or you can use the Hubble telescope. Which would you want to use? Of course, the astronomer would want the Hubble telescope. Well, entheogens are the same way. If you really want to look at yourself and your psyche and your emotions and your spirit, do you want to look with your naked eye, or do you want to use the Hubble telescope? Let's use the Hubble telescope. But then people using these things irresponsibly or just playfully and, putting out this information for politicians to feed off of doesn't help anyone. Doesn't help the picture, doesn't help us achieve what we really can with these very powerful tools. Let's respect them and use them in a good way. So that's what I'm trying to do in Mushroom Wisdom and Sage Spirit and in my new book as well, is really trying to get people to say, "Hey, let's be serious about it."
I could not agree with you more, and I've seen some radio show stunts where they've taken salvia and just done really stupid things, and then a few weeks later you'll hear about a state outlawing the stuff, and it's just really sad because this is our religious freedom that these people are toying with, and them going around and just doing these things willy-nilly without any understanding and just complete disrespect because the rest of society is so ignorant of these things, then all it does is perpetuate the suppression of them and our spiritual and religious freedom as well. So I also
Yeah, it really feeds in.
go
I was
ahead.
just going to say, it really feeds into the whole. It feeds into the whole reactionary system that we have, right? Where somebody does something stupid, politician stands up and then starts, spewing out fear and propaganda. So then we've got to take action, and then we've got more prisoners. We've got to build more jails, and it's like this continual cycle where we're not stepping back and say, well, hey, let's talk rationally about this, and especially let's talk about issues of freedom, about religious freedom, about personal freedom, spiritual freedom, and let's take a look at what we're doing to our society by just reacting out of fear and propaganda. And so I just think the whole cycle is vicious and terribly unfortunate and, well, unconstitutional too. Let's throw that in.
I agree with you. So let me ask you this. With your experience with salvia, have you ever experienced a very female entity or spirit with the plant?
I would say yes and no. Now, my experiences with salvia, oh man, there's just so many different kinds of experiences. I mean, salvia is really interesting that way that there's sort of a fundamental matrix of salvia energy that tends to be present in any salvia experience. But then beyond that, I mean, just the variety of experiences I've had are just phenomenal. And so I would say energetically, I have experienced many different kinds of being, some more feminine, some more masculine. I've experienced a lot of sort of shape-shifting experiences. But I think in getting at your question, I mean, I know that salvia is considered to be feminine in many respects. And, you know, among the Mazatecs, it's referred to as, you know, the Virgin Mother Mary, and or as the shepherdess of the forest. And so it's considered to have kind of a female energy to it. And I would say in some respects, yes, I've experienced that, but in other respects, no, because it really depends on the actual, you know, that particular journey, what happened in that journey. So it varies for me, I would say.
Yeah, I also noticed something, you know, and my experience with salvia isn't all that deep, I would say. I haven't used it near as much as other entheogens, maybe only 70 or 80 times, so I consider myself rather inexperienced with it, and you know, as far as I would like to be. And one thing that I notice with it is that I also find myself often, my whole body will want to turn to the right and do strange things with it. Is that something that you found as well?
Yeah, I mean, this kind of gets back to the idea that I mentioned that there's sort of this fundamental energetic matrix that comes out with Salvia divinorum. And really, I like to think in terms of energy when I'm dealing with different entheogens, because different entheogens open you up to different experiences and perceptions of energy. Now,
Completely.
salvia energy is very fluid, it's very serpentine, and it's almost kind of sticky and viscous in a sense. And so salvia, and taking salvia and opening yourself up to that energy, it's kind of this hyperdimensional energy. So it moves through you physically, it moves through you emotionally, mentally, spiritually, and it flows. And especially, I like to take salvia in the dark. I tend to do it with my eyes closed. I find that it's much easier to actually see the salvia if you're in the complete darkness. And when you really watch the energy, and you watch the way that it's flowing, that you can see, you know, like you might feel that your left hand suddenly starts moving, or you start leaning to the right, or you start swaying in a certain direction. Well, if you can see the energy, you'll see that actually you're just fitting into those patterns of energy, you know. And it's kind of, again, salvia is something that opens up a lot of fear in people because it does have this kind of overwhelming flow. It's almost like this psychedelic tsunami that just kind of washes over you, especially if you're using like enhanced leaf or something like that, where one second you think it's not doing anything, and by the time you get to the end of your thought, suddenly you're in this tremendous psychedelic flow of this energy just kind of ebbing and flowing and pulling. And a lot of people react with fear to that. I mean, I get emails from people all the time saying, "Oh, I tried salvia for the first time and I thought I was dying," because they feel this energy sort of pulling them and spreading them out. But if people can just relax and go with that, well, that's just the energy of salvia. And then when you really get focused on that, rather than letting it move you, I find that you can direct it. I mean, you can direct it towards people or situations. So I might use that in a healing context with someone. I find especially using sound, vocalizations, drumming, you can really direct that energy. And like behind my closed eyes, what I tend to find is that there is a central vortex of the energy, and the energy is all flowing in and out of that vortex. And sometimes there might be multiple ones, but you really can direct that. You can direct where that energy is going. So, for example, if I'm doing a salvia circle with a group of people, and if it's my turn and I'm using the salvia and my eyes are closed, I find that that vortex will usually point to one person within the circle and start directing energy to that person. And I'll do all this with my eyes closed. And then when I open my eyes, I generally will see that that person is over there receiving all this energy. I mean, they're actually in a posture where maybe their arms are out or something like that, and they're receiving it. And then later they'll tell me, "Well, I had this vision, or this, you know, this spirit came to me, or this energy came to me." And so that's kind of the way that it can be used. But it's esoteric. I think that Salvia is much more esoteric than mushrooms. It's harder to understand. A lot of people who use it say, wow, that was like a bizarre fun house. I didn't understand that at all. So I think it takes a little bit more getting used to and working with. And it's definitely very different from mushrooms. I mean, there's no comparison between the two, really.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. And I've pushed myself at times to try and get more familiar with it, and I've been using it more and more just recently. But it really is just so much different. And what I often find is that if I'm guiding someone else through an experience, I find it very useful for me as a tool to help other people more than I find it as a tool for my own exploration, simply because I just don't have the understanding that it seems clear that you do with it. I wanted to ask you from that point, what has your experience been with eating or drinking salvia or using it in a tincture form?
Okay, well, certainly the generally most effective way to get a fast reaction from salvia is through smoking it. Smoking the enhanced leaf is always the fastest and most powerful. I mean, if you take one hit that's big enough of the enhanced leaf, that's all you need. Smoking just regular salvia leaf that hasn't been enhanced, you usually have to smoke, a large bowl or two large bowls before you really get to, the fullness of the experience. Then the other forms is you can actually take the leaves and you can chew on them. And some people swallow it, but really, Daniel Siebert has shown that the alkaloids are really only absorbed in your mouth. So, swallowing salvia is really not going to do anything for you. So if you chew the leaves, you want to keep it in your mouth. Ideally, you keep it underneath your tongue. I've found that that's a nice kind of mellow way of enjoying salvia. The experience comes on slower, it's not as strong, it lasts longer, but it can be very subtle at that point. Personally, my personal preference is for entheogens that really just stand up and say, "Hello, I'm here." I think that it's much clearer. It can be much scarier for people in that state, but I think that the communication is much clearer at that level about what's going on and how to use them. So I tend to like stronger experiences. If you chew enough, you can have a fairly strong experience. However, the more you chew, the more bitter it becomes. And it's kind of tastes like really, really strong spinach. It has this strong kind of bitterness to it. And it can be hard to effectively get yourself to chew enough to really enter into a strong experience just because it is really bitter. And then another method would be using a tincture of extracted salvinorin A that's been extracted directly out of the plants. And that usually comes in an alcohol solution. And well, I guess the two things that I would say about that is one, you can have a great experience. You can definitely have a nice, strong experience that lasts for a while doing that. But the flip side of that is putting that tincture under your tongue hurts so bad. I mean, my first reaction in putting that tincture in my mouth is just like, oh my God, what have I just put in my mouth? And I can just feel my tongue just pulsing and pounding in pain. And my eyes are welling up with tears, and I think I can hardly handle this. Now, you keep that tincture under your tongue for about 15 minutes. By the end of the 15 minutes, you're pretty much fully involved in the salvia experience at that point. And then the burning sensation on your tongue actually feels good. And I find that my tongue goes searching around in my mouth for like, well, where's more of the burn? But initially, it really, really, really hurts. And ideally, you should water down the tincture with some hot water so that it's a little bit more manageable in your mouth. But one time I was feeling particularly cavalier and I was like, I'm only going to water this down a very bare minimum. And I got to say, my mouth felt like it was burned, like when you drink like a drink that's too hot. It felt that way for about the next week and a half after that. I just felt like I had burned my lips and my gums and my tongue, and so my mouth was definitely in pain. Now, it was a nice, strong salvia experience, but not the most comfortable. So I tend to smoke it when I use it. And I do find that if you're smoking it, the experience itself doesn't last very long. It's generally like 10 to 15 minutes, but you can actually maintain that for quite a long time. So I've gone for sessions where I just kind of mildly keep smoking it for several hours and just spend a lot of time in that state. And you kind of get a little, you go a little bit deeper and then you come back out a little bit. But you can maintain it by smoking it. But it also, it burns really hot when you smoke it, so that's uncomfortable for some people as well.
It does, and it burns very fast too. It's completely unlike cannabis when it burns.
Right, which is, man, and just speaking of that, it just cracks me up when I, well, it cracks me up and makes me angry too of the ignorance when I see articles or people talking about salvia, especially politicians saying, people are, it's a substitute for marijuana and it's legal. And it's like, it is so unlike cannabis in any respect. I mean, there's no similarity in it. And if you are going to salvia as a substitute for cannabis, you're a fool because they are not the same in any respect at all.
And not only that, but most of the entheogenic experiences are so profound you couldn't use them like cannabis, you know?
No. I mean, you couldn't just, you wouldn't want to be doing salvia all the time or anything. I mean, the experiences can be very bizarre. Personally, I find salvia just fascinating. I mean, it's just such a fascinating subject of going into those experiences, but you can't do that all the time.
Right.
It's that's got to, with any entheogen, people should, regulate their use and use them when they feel that, okay, there's something I can really get out of it at this point. Well, then you go and you visit with that medicine. But, just going one experience after another isn't necessarily helping people if they're not like really processing and working with that and using that to say, okay, who am I? Where am I going? What am I doing? We can use these as tools to help us along with that. But if we're just jumping from one experience to the next, then we're not really integrating and processing because all of these experiences are just beautiful learning opportunities, but it often takes time to really sort through, wow, what did I learn? What did I really go through there? And kind of like what you mentioned about using mushroom wisdom for more experienced people, I find that a lot of us need reminders too about, well, let's remember what it is that we're doing here and what we're trying to get out of it rather than just what's the next big vision or what's the next big experience. It's like, what am I learning? What am I doing with myself by using these entheogens? What's my personal path and education that I'm getting out of this?
One more question about salvia, and this is a subject that a friend of mine has talked to me about, who's done salvia probably two or three times more than I have, so I'm guessing probably in the ballpark of about 300 experiences. And one thing that he said was that he was at home in his living room with a friend. He smoked salvia and then traveled to another place where he had a vision where he was smoking salvia at another location. And then when he saw himself smoking salvia at the second location, he went through time back to the first experience. Now, closing that experience. And then a week later, he found himself at this location that he had the vision of, smoking salvia. And then having the same vision where he returned back to the first experience and then came back again. So sort of like a wormhole time travel type of thing. Have you ever experienced anything like that with it?
I've never experienced anything like that, but hearing something like that is completely unsurprising because really, I mean, in my like visual perception of salvia, and also, and I mean, it's much more than just visual perception because when you're in an entheogenic state, you're not just seeing something, you're feeling it, you're experiencing it, you're being it all at the same time, is that basically salvia energy is made up of hyperdimensional portals. I mean, it's like, it's hyperspace is kind of what it's like, is that in that, I mean, I can see these vortexes, and it's totally unsurprising to me that you might go through a vortex and end up in another place in space and time. And I've heard a lot of accounts of people using salvia and then finding themselves in a completely realistic environment that is not the environment that they're actually in. For example, Daniel Siebert has talked to me about how one of his very first, like, very strong salvia experiences, where he took salvia and then he found himself in a room that looked like a perfectly normal room and everything was totally normal and he didn't feel like he was tripping at all. But he suddenly realized, I think he said he was in his grandmother's house when he was just a little kid. And he's back there, and then he realizes, oh my God, this is not the right time. And he instantly left that time. And then this happened 7 or 8 more times where he ended up in different places where he had been in his life, but was not now. And then he reached a point where he's like, oh my God, I'm never going to get back to the right time. I'm never going to get back to my place in space-time. But he eventually did. But it's kind of a similar sort of experience. So it really does not sound surprising that to me, I really perceive Salvia energy as kind of, it's almost like this underground network of space-time energy consciousness where, portals between different realms seems completely realistic. And I know, for people who's never tried Salvia or people who aren't really interested in entheogens, they're, talking like this, they just say, wow, you're totally crazy, aren't you? But that's really what it look, you know, that's what it looks like to me. It looks like wormholes and hyperspace. So, yeah, that seems completely realistic to me.
And well, if people all I can say is to people with those type of judgments, dare try these things and see if you can come to a different conclusion once you do. So next, I wanted to talk about a new book. And a few weeks from possibly, maybe a little over a month ago, you sent me an excerpt of a new book that you've been working on about changing the laws towards the use of entheogens and things like that. Could you sort of give an introduction about your book there and the plans that you have for it?
Yeah, the book that I'm working on right now is called The Entheogenic Evolution, and I've named it after the podcast that I've been working on for about the past 8 months. And as you mentioned, that there is a large focus on the idea of entheogen use as actually as a human right, as something that should be considered from a legal perspective, from a human right issue. There's really a lot of different things that I'm doing in the book, but to kind of describe the inspiration for it, I mean, one inspiration was just the different ideas I've been working with on my podcast. And the other really major inspiration is over this past year, I had the opportunity to experience 5-MeO-DMT for the first time. And that experience was so profound. I mean, it's such a deep mystical experience that I just felt that I just got launched right into the heart of God and had this complete union experience with divine source, which is not something that I had experienced previously with my other entheogen usage. And I was so profoundly affected by that that the thought that this could be illegal really upset me because, I mean, this was the experience I had been looking for my entire life, and suddenly there it was, delivered through this chemical key. And now 5-MeO-DMT is not a Schedule I substance currently. Who knows how long that will be true, but it's potentially. You can be prosecuted under the Analog Substances Act. But that really got me hot under the collar that here is this profound, amazing, mystical medicine, and we're outlawing this stuff. We're making it illegal for people to have these experiences. And for myself, it was the most important personal experience I've ever had in my life. And for me, that was the most intimate possible experience I could ever have. I mean, unification with God or the divine source of the universe. What could be more intimate than that? And I really got to thinking, if I'm not free to have this experience the way that I want to have it, then I really don't have any kind of freedom because this is the most intimate, most fundamental freedom I could ever possibly have is my freedom to experience God. And if somebody can legislate it, making me a criminal to have that experience, then I do not have any kind of freedom whatsoever at all. Anything else is just an illusion. So I really got fired up about this. And what I ended up doing for the book, The Entheogenic Evolution, is I kind of go through, in the chapter that I sent you, for example, I kind of go through a whole history of the role that entheogens have had in spiritual experience, in the development of religion and culture, going back to prehistoric times, up through the formation of the main religious traditions of the world. And so I'm really trying to point out, the role that entheogens have had historically in human culture and their significance and how much of what we take as religion today really originates from the use of entheogens in ancient history. And then looking at how did things become so biased against entheogens in Western culture? So I look at the rise of Christianity, the rise of science and objectivism and all of these things. And then eventually I get into an analysis of looking at the United States Constitution, looking at Supreme Court cases that have involved entheogens, such as the Smith case and the UDV case. I look at the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which was written as a response to the Supreme Court saying that Native Americans don't have a right to use peyote in their ceremonies. And then I kind of analyze the more recent case of the Unión do Vegetal, which was arguing for their use to use ayahuasca, and looking at that relationship to the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. And even though the Supreme Court did not find it in the favor of the UDV, they did not find in favor of Alberto Gonzalez and the government as well, so that they said that the government did not make a good argument for why the UDV couldn't use ayahuasca, and but they also didn't say that the UDV did have the right to use ayahuasca. So then, in the end of that chapter, is I write up what I propose as the Universal Declaration of the Human Right to Direct Spiritual Experience, and within that chapter, I really make a strong argument for how entheogens can open us up to direct spiritual experience that is unmediated by any other person or tradition or belief or dogma, and that ultimately is what true freedom is our ability to explore ourselves as we choose and as we see fit, as long as that's not infringing on the rights of any other person or harming any other person in any direct way, that is our most fundamental freedom. And so that's really what I'm rooting for in that chapter of the book. And then really the rest of the book is looking at what it means to use entheogens spiritually. And I look at questions of, 2012 and Terence McKenna and Daniel Pinchbeck. I spend a lot of time talking about 5-MeO-DMT and ayahuasca, and really there's a lot of subjects in the book, but really I'm feeling very passionate about that at this point, that I really feel that there's a great injustice being done to people in outlawing these medicines. And so I really want to make as much noise as I can and say, look, we have got to reevaluate this picture of what it is that we are doing to ourselves and our freedom and our ability to have spiritual experiences. And we need a serious reassessment, and we need to reframe this discussion. And it's time to make some changes.
I could not agree with you more, and I really feel that you're doing some important work in this area. There's a book that was written by Peter McWilliams back in the 90s called "Ain't Nobody's Business If You Do," the absurdity of consensual crimes in our free country. And the author, Peter McWilliams, he was a medical marijuana patient. He had cancer, and he had also gotten AIDS through a blood transfusion. And this was just right after California's Proposition 215 was passed for medical marijuana. And he and another well-known activist, Todd McCormick, set out immediately after the law was passed to start growing medical cannabis legally underneath California law. Well, eventually what came to pass was that Peter McWilliams was arrested for conspiracy to grow marijuana, regardless of Prop 215, regardless of his medical condition. And he ended up dying of asphyxiation from vomit, unable to use the medicine that he was prescribed for that very purpose. And this book, Ain't Nobody's Business If You Do, was sent to all members of the U.S. Congress and Senate after it was written. And in a way, I think it was his outspokenness and challenging the paradigm about what freedom really is. And his concept is, my freedom ends where your nose begins. In other words, if I'm not affecting the person or property of another, you stay out of my business. It's my person, it's my effects, period. And this does not apply to things like driving, etc., because driving, you're out in the public, but if you're in your own home, you know, if somebody doesn't like what you do, they can close their window or turn away or, you know, things like that. But if you're not where you're putting other people in direct danger, and people
Right.
are old enough and they've been educated on the use and truth of these plants, and there's no reason why they should be illegal at all. And so, you know, I really applaud you for the work that you're doing right now on this subject. And I feel that your work is very significant, as far as the work that you're doing and the book that you're writing now is very significant to my own book that's officially released as of today.
Yes.
I'm going to be putting up today that it's available for pre-orders. I've just put in my first order for it today. So, but my new book, The Holy Mushroom, I really set out to prove to the academic community the religious use of mushrooms in Judeo-Christianity, and to show that we really do have this history there, that it's not just something like Andrew Letcher argues that was made up by Wasson and McKenna in the 1950s and 70s, and there really is a
Yeah.
significant history there. And you know, I really think that Andy Letcher has done the entire entheogen community a disfavor in the way that he wrote his book and failing to follow up on a lot of the newer research and academic journals and things. So I see between your book and my book and this book that actually was released just. What was it, day before yesterday, Professor John Rush's book, Failed God, Fractured Myth in a Fragile World, and he also proves that Christianity is based on mushrooms. I really think that you know, we can really start moving forward now and affecting this change, because now that we can prove that these religions have a history of use of these things, then they're even in violation of the history of their own religion. And that's, I think, something that will be powerful in our approach to dismantling this drug war.
Yeah, I think it's so important that we get an accurate picture of the historical origins of religion and the role that entheogens have played in religion. I think that is just so fundamental. And I think, for example, like your video, The Pharmacratic Inquisition, shows really well that not only was this history there, but it's also been covered up, and that there have been concerted efforts made through religion, through politics, through science, through all of these things to really cut us off from having those kinds of experiences ourselves. That, really in developing its hegemony on truth and spiritual experience, the Christian Church really removed the possibility of people coming to these kinds of experiences themselves from the picture. I mean, they went around the globe and they killed as many shamans as they could and demonized them. I mean, literally, and this
And
is what they did in Europe as well.
they're still doing it. They're still demonizing shamans, and they're still sending their missionaries into these areas, destroying these ancient cultures and these ancient practices, and filling these people's heads with contradiction and fear with their dogmatic religion. And I find it despicable.
Yeah, I think it's just, I mean, that's another thing that kind of gets my blood boiling. So I'll try not to go off on that too much. But
I
I mean,
just did
just
for you.
good, because I mean, I personally, I feel highly motivated by what I perceive as the truth, and part of that is recognizing the truth of this history, and then looking at, we've actually had 2,000 years that, the war on drugs and our attitude towards entheogens and psychedelics today, they're so much shaped by this 2,000-year history in the West and all the different cultural developments that, it's time for us to really be honest about where our origins are, how power has been manipulated through the course of history, and how things that we're suffering from now, politically and socially, really are the effects of these kinds of attitudes of, controlling people, controlling knowledge, controlling access to spiritual experience, and belittling and demonizing or converting other people in this whole control and monopoly on truth. I mean, on one side, we have sort of scientific monopoly of truth, and on the other side, we have religious monopoly of truth. And, I want to get at the real truth within there, and that involves recognizing what the real history is, and then also really looking truthfully at what are questions of freedom, what are questions of spiritual freedom, spiritual rights, religious freedom, religious rights, and looking at these things from a very honest perspective that is not caught up in the propaganda, the lies, the distortion, and the fear, really.
Well said. Well, if you could summarize for me in a couple of minutes what you would like the listeners to take home and to spread to other people, what would that be?
Well, I would really want to emphasize just the responsible use of entheogens and, respecting them for what they are, that these are very sacred tools that can really transform yourself, they can really transform your life, but there's also a danger to them. They do open you up to psychic forces that are inside of yourself that if people are not prepared, they can do damage to themselves, they can have, bad trips, that they can, have experiences that can haunt them for years. So, while I do promote entheogens as very powerful tools and as healing agents, I also want people to be sure that they're approaching them with caution and with knowledge and with education. And that's really what I'm trying to do with my podcast, is trying, educate people as best I can, as best as I'm able to, and to encourage people not just to use these things in a serious and intentful way, but also trying to give practical advice for how do you do that? How do you really approach these things? And so I really encourage people to educate themselves. I encourage people to, read books like your book, The Holy Mushroom, and really get an idea of what is the history of entheogen use in Western culture? Where are our religions coming from? I mean, this stuff is so eye-opening. And I encourage people to move beyond the propaganda, move beyond the fear. And, I encourage people to think rationally about this. Think twice before putting your stupid video on YouTube. Think about how you are either helping or, helping the entheogenic community or the psychedelic community, or are you helping the system? Let's think about it. Also, I would encourage people to stand up, that if they use these medicines and if they find value in them, stand up about it, don't be victimized as a criminal and say, look, I'm a responsible, legitimate, free person that I have a right to make choices about myself. And, we need people to stand up about this. I think, for example, Alex Gray once said, why don't more artists stand up and say, yeah, I've used psychedelics and that influences my art, so that people could really know, and he was a little bit peeved about that more people wouldn't take responsibility for that. And so I kind of urge people to stand up, be open and honest about it. And, something I've got to say is that ever since publishing Mushroom Wisdom, I've been very open about my use of entheogens, and I have personally been amazed how well people have responded to that, from my family members who didn't know about that, my parents, my employers, people I've worked for. I've really been impressed how people have respected that fact about me and have been interested to learn more. And so I encourage other people to take responsibility for themselves and for their use of these medicines and stand up and defend them when it's appropriate, because something's got to change, and it's not going to change if people just cower and let themselves live in fear. So let's stand up. Let's make a change. Let's do it. But it's going to take a lot of people. It's going to take all of us doing it together. So I'm ready. You're ready. Let's do it.
Let's do it. And, I really appreciate your work and what you're doing right now. And I think change is on the horizon. I think with all of these new publications coming out on, I think 5 books in the next year from this week on entheogens and Christianity, And I think people are, things are starting to change. People are really starting to reconsider and look at these things. We've been speaking with Dr. Martin Ball. He is the author of Mushroom Wisdom, and he's also the author of Sage Spirit and the forthcoming book, Entheogenic Evolution. His website is www.martinball.net. And Martin, would you like to add anything else to the show or give out a personal email address or anything like that?
Yeah, I'd say anybody's welcome to write me at martinball@verizon.net. And I would encourage your listeners to check out the Entheogenic Evolution podcast. That's at www.entheogenic.podomatic.com, or they can find it on iTunes. And of course, I have two episodes with you over there. So I'd encourage them to come over there and listen to that if they haven't heard that already.
And you've been listening to Gnostic Media's podcast with your host, Jan Irvin. This has been in podcast number 3 with Dr. Martin Ball. Martin, thank you so much for coming on today. It's been a great show, and I really appreciate the work you're doing.
All right. Thanks, Jan. I really appreciate the work you're doing as well. And best of luck to you and Gnostic Media. And let's keep in touch and keep moving forward.
You've got it.
Take you home with me and tuck you into bed. I'd love to see what makes you tick inside your head. perfection. Perfection is my goal. Do you think you're better than me? Do you want to kill me or befriend me? Christian nation, make us all right. Put us to the filter and make us pure and white. Cause my mind has wandered, the flock is seizing, and the flock has wandered away from me. And let's talk of family values while we sit and watch the slaughter. Hypothetical abortions and imaginary daughters. The white folks stink their at the top, ask any proud white male. A million years of evolution, we get Danny Quayle.
I'd love to hear you weep. I'd love to listen to you while you're screaming.